have a few random comments. I've plumbed some old figures, but there is a purpose to this. It's essentially to talk about different approaches as we approach the hope for detection of R, which is sort of naive in a way. May already be doing them, but it's worthwhile to put them on the table, perhaps. So I thought this is amusing. Over the years, one has given many talks on these subjects, and this was from, oh, I don't know, vintage 08 or so, where everything was supposed to have been done. Somehow it's cut off the, oh no, there they are. There was 1 year of Planck, because Planck wasn't going to get more than 1 year. WMAP-8 was supposed to be folded into this in a grand unified combination. SBT Act and Quiet were all well done, with Quiet having done some polarization for us. BICEP, of course, was highly advanced by that time, Quiet. And, then Spider would have flown. All of the analysis would have been done. And Clover would have been a reality. And so this was some kind of projection. The only reason I'm showing this is that this was with that kind of assumption, the breakup of the power spectrum with B modes that might be possible to do. And no matter, oh, sorry.
And so no matter what way you did it, the number of bands that you would put together would not be that high. And so it's like we're going back to a period, even with optimistic projections, to a period which is like the beginnings of detections in T and the beginnings of the detections in E. And so there were a number of strategies that when used to try and sort of, I wouldn't say leverage more out of the data, but show it in different ways. And also there's another issue, which I think is sort of obvious, is that when you only have a few bands that are well determined, trying to do parameter estimation from just a few band compression can be a bit dangerous, and so it's good to try other methods. Anyway, that was sort of a historical reminder. So as everybody is probably aware, I like to push the acceleration aspect of inflation, because that's what the definition of inflation is. And so we now have evidence, which I think is really neat, that the early universe vacuum is differentially accelerating. That is to say, it's not uniform. And there's a relationship between the acceleration defined by the running of the Hubble parameter with respect to A. It's equal to 1 plus the famous deceleration parameter defined in cosmology, in which there is this relationship that's approximate between R and epsilon, and the point here is that R also runs, and the expectation that it's a constant is not a true expectation, as we know, and the question is how well we can do with that. But if you do have a full trajectory set of information about the acceleration, then you can determine, as we have already seen much discussed, the inflaton in units of root 2 m Planck, which is just related to the square root of epsilon, and you can reconstruct the effective potential if there's only the inflaton direction, which involves epsilon and h is just the integral of epsilon. One of the key features that we get to deal with at an approximate level is the relationship between wave number, which is a resolution thing, and dynamics, which is HA, because a lot of the physics is determined just when K goes as HA. So what we've been pushing for a number of years, never quite get a publication out, is using trajectory probabilities for early inflatons. We've had publications on late inflatons. And trajectories are actually a really good way to go. In effect, that's what we do when we do band power analysis. We're expanding in a mode function except that the mode functions are simple. They're usually assumed to be top hats. And so this is an issue of going beyond top hats. Like I say, this is all really trivial stuff, right? But one of the issues is whether or not your mode expansion is a totally blind one. There's no such thing. Or partially blind, that is to say that you are making no constraints on the values your parameters can take, whereas you might try and expand in mode functions that are informed. For example, the best would be just one single mode function for the B mode power spectrum, which would be what is predicted of what the shape would be with just one amplitude to be determined. That's an informed theory prior. So there is nothing that says that the compression into power spectrum has to be on the kind of band power compression. Of course, this has been known for a long time. And the other point is that you can use equations such as this to make trajectories and then to recompress them onto new modes. And the issue then becomes, how do you describe the statistics of the information that you've got on those new modes? And that's the tricky thing, but it's also the tricky thing when we do compression onto power spectra in the usual way. That is to say, you really are supposed to know the full likelihood surface with all of these multidimensional band power parameters, and then we check that at some level, but usually not with infinite accuracy, and say, hey, you know, if I pull the modes far enough apart, it looks pretty Gaussian, and then I can do a complete characterization of the modes as you vary the, you know, the single mode parameter as opposed to doing the cross correlation. But you can also do that with this recompression onto modes. So over the years, anyway, the modes that I'm going to talk about here and that are of some interest, I think, for the whole issue of the movement into trying to go for B modes and the interpretation as tensors is modes that are motivated by the early universe as opposed to motivated by just doing a blind analysis on CL. Over the years, we've, you know, used every variable imaginable, and one of the reasons that we never published the paper, in spite of the huge amount of work we did, is because there is a really unfortunate thing about mode expansions, but this is actually true just generally, which you can be dependent upon the priors that you put in. Of course, that's also true for anything that goes on in inflation and other such things. Who knows what the prior is on the fundamental parameters that you're in quest of? But I mean, the, you know, logical parameters to do the expansions are the Hubble parameter, the log of the Hubble parameter, epsilon, which I quite like, but we went away from. Why did we do that? Well, one of the things is epsilon has to be between 0 and 1. Does it have to be less equal to 0. We certainly don't impose that, unfortunately, upon the trajectories that we allow for late inflation, for some stupid reason, but there you go. You know, that's supercritical expansion that people always love to do the symmetrical situation. Anyway, that's another issue. The one of the ones which is actually pretty good is D-lon epsilon D-lon K, and we'll see the reason for that in a moment. That's actually intimately related to NS minus 1, and it gives you better control than this, where you have to throw away a lot of trajectories that are hugging the value towards 0. But other ones that are equally valid that allow you to derive what the acceleration history are is you can expand, and this is an obvious one in the spectral index, NS. And another one, which actually we tend to be using now, that's a little bit better controlled, is a mode expansion in ln PS, and of course NS is just derived as the derivative of it. But as I said, the trouble is you put in modes with amplitudes, and it's measure dependent, measure being the amplitude of the modes that you're expanding in. What was the prior that you put upon them? Do you decide it's logarithmic? Do you decide it's linear? We usually decide it's linear, but not necessarily. But then there can be physical constraints that are added to the evolution of these parameters that will pop you out of an allowed regime. And so you also get enhancements of the measure prior associated on the coefficients from what are allowed trajectories. And that can actually be very important. And so you have to probe what your prior actually is, and you have to be very careful. One of the things which people have done and done a lot of in the in this game, because this game is a huge game, is they've done potential expansions, and then they throw in a bunch of statistical parameters, and then they try and do V reconstructions in that way. That is not a very good approach. We've used it, but we've more or less abandoned that approach, because you have to end up rejecting a huge number of the throws of the dice, and so you really do a huge impact on the prior probability, and you have to really try and understand that. But this is being heavily used in early universe gamesmanship. In particular, people are using it to quote-unquote explore the landscape, and whenever you hear that, you should take it with a grain of salt. But it's being done, and people are making inferences from that. The issue then, once again, is the issue is whether it's your prior on the expansion parameters that you use. Okay, the prior dependence is sort of completely obvious in the simplest case that we know, which is that using only TT information and WMAP information, what is the true limit on R? And it's very, very sensitive to the issue of the assumption that it's a uniform prior in R as opposed to, let's say, logarithmic or logarithmic with an offset. And it turns out that the linear is a bit better in my view, because the linear is actually less constrained. You put the logarithmic, and then because you're allowing so many small r's, it tends to try and shoot the limit down, and you would say all these things are ruled out, and they aren't ruled out. Anyway, that's just, you know, we know this, and people using funny priors have, there was a French group that said, we have detected R at one point by misunderstanding priors. So the modes that I'm talking about here are modes in terms of an expansion of power spectra. And they, as I said, the modes can be quite complicated. So what that means is that you're operating in a quadratic amplitude tensor amplitude space. And what is interesting in that, and I think that this is well known, but it's actually almost an exact correspondence. The filtering that's being done when you're determining the amplitude of the modes are basically dealing with the amplitude-amplitude observations, and they're saying, I am going to grab what is optimal from you, just like happens when you do Wiener filtering on amplitudes. You're always trying to pick out the best pattern, and that's what the Wiener filter is all about, and it's essentially the same thing. And so the different modes that you hit the, if you like, delta-delta adjoint a combination with, that you get, you're going to get different results. That's the optimal way to determine it. So one aspect of this as we go along, I want to say a word or two in praise of something that shouldn't require any praise, of the oldest way to do parameter estimation, the sort of thing that we could do in the COBE days, which was direct amplitude cross amplitude determination of parameters in some kind of grid with large matrices. Now, it turns out the ability to do very, very large matrices has improved over time, and so then we think that this is actually feasible for at least a modest number of parameters for the full spider analysis. We shall see, and it doesn't mean that we aren't going to use things. We plan to use X faster, and you can do hybrids. It's not unlike the likelihood that we're doing with Planck, and it was done for WMAP, where you make some kind of split for high L and low L, and you're really trying to work in pixel-pixel space. And so we want to work in pixel-pixel space, QU space, and we heard that, wow. We heard that BICEP and Keck are moving towards the same direction, and we think it's a good direction. I mean, you know, you might be able to make the other work. We've all seen this a billion times. I just wanted to reemphasize something which I think is really interesting, which is that we are well away from the uniform acceleration line, and so that's the differential acceleration result. And we have that with just the TT and the WMAP polarization, but presumably you already know we're away from that line with a direct B-mode measurement, whatever your ultimate limit is from the BICEP2 results. Okay, so back to the acceleration and the concept of using inflation consistency. So it is clear that if you're going to make a full case for having discovered the B mode and relating it to tensors, you're going to try and do everything that you can as blindly as you can, because you don't want the the audience will require that you did all of that stuff. But it's still true that you can also tease more information out of the data. And one of the things which is not inevitable, but pretty compelling within an inflationary framework, is that there is a consistency, the inflation consistency, that is more than just that the tensor slope is essentially R over 8, and it's therefore related to epsilon, and then this consistency relationship, which is approximate as well, between the spectral index and epsilon and d epsilon d long k. It's more than that. It's a full functional relationship that occurs, which is actually defined by this grouping up here, which says that if I know this, it turns out I know that, but even more so. So the epsilon approach is like a path approach to inflation, as opposed to writing down the EFT Lagrangian, which I will say I actually do like very much, but I also like to push your buttons on occasion, because it is a re-expression of stuff that has been being done all along. And one of the ingredients which is extremely important in inflation is the opening up of the other degrees of freedom. I mean, this is also an issue with this as well, except that the concept of inflation is explicitly acceleration. And then the question is, what is the probability, the prior probability of allowed acceleration trajectories? Open issue, obviously. So you can derive the scalar power, the tensor power, V and psi. And you can do is, if you write down the mode, sorry, the perturbative amplitudes for the scalar field and zeta and all of that stuff, you see directly, that is to say, the Mukhanov Sasaki equation, you see directly that the one term which is key in this is epsilon. And so you know epsilon, you know the driver of that perturbative equation, and you can therefore fully solve, given this, the full K-mode integration, asymptotically as well. Now, it turns out, and I'm going to show something like this, even though I was mentioning some issues about this, it's easy to do full K-mode integration. Integrations are so fast. And so what we do when we're doing analysis of this kind of modal attempt is it's fully built into the MCMC programs that are used to try and find the parameters. So in other words, if you have some kind of acceleration trajectory, you go into the acceleration trajectory and you calculate the modes, and then you test that. You calculate the full perturbative things, and then you test that, and then you go and you roll the dice again, you get a new acceleration trajectory, you calculate what the spectrum is, and you go in and check that with the data. And so it's an ongoing process, and what we used to do was an approximation based upon stochastic inflation of that, in which there was no full K integration, but the speed is such that it really doesn't matter at all, and it's nice to be accurate. But how accurate do you have to be? And this goes back to the issue that I was talking about, but I went back to these old figures and showed that it really doesn't matter very much for the tensor mode. And of course, that was the discussion. So, something get cut off here. How did that happen?
Moved it. You did something.
No, you see, I had on one of these figures. I can't find it. Geez, I wonder what happened to it. I had Excel. See, there's epsilon here. That was showing you a line. I don't know what happened. There was a line showing you how wild the trajectory was over these wave numbers, read HA, and what the response is of an exact calculation compared to the slow roll approximation, which is essentially using this simple Hamilton-Jacobi relationship. And so exact was black when this was that, and somehow, I don't know if it's, geez, I was looking at this just a second ago. Anyway, so let me just wave my hands and show you what it was like. So this was a fairly gentle variation for epsilon, and the slow roll approximation is essentially bang on this line for the tensor power spectrum, but you see that there are some deviations which one can't ignore here. This was a wild variation situation, and the deviations of the scalar power spectrum are much bigger, but it turns out that the tensor power spectrum is almost exact even for a very wild variation. And so this, I withdraw what my question was to you earlier in the day, that in fact, this tensor is very robust to very wide, fairly wild variations in epsilon.
What are you doing now? You checking phone
manuals
for epsilon?
No. This was an exact epsilon, you know, a full functional form for epsilon, and then driving the perturbative equations. Oh yeah, it was just to show impact, right? I mean, this has been shown by a number of people. So the question is, if you're going to roll dice with different epsilons, at what level do you have to go to the exact calculation of the power spectra? Or at what level can you just do, one of these approximations? And it turns out, to a good extent, you can just use the approximations.
Sorry, you're varying epsilon while keeping H constant?
Mm-hmm. No. Epsilon integrates to give you H. So there's a structure to H, which is an integral of epsilon. So, you know, there's this equation is a defining equation for epsilon, which is also a first order equation to give you what ln H looks like, right? You still need the overall scale because there's obviously a constant there.
But Dick, so when you talk,
I don't know what happened to this figure.
When you talk about like choosing a trajectory, not in this case, but in any case,
I don't get it. So when I put it into this. Movie mode or slideshow mode, but this is what I was looking at, and this is now what you're looking at. This is it. I don't know what it is. Anyway, it doesn't matter. Now you can see it. So see, this is actually fairly dramatic. And let me remind you, you multiply this by 16 and you find out what the effect of R is. So this is sort of at the limit. Minus six or so is actually where we usually do the pivoting normalization of R. L equals 100 is about here. And so, you know, this one was fairly gentle over the range where you can actually probe the tensor. This one's actually got variation, and the variations became bigger as you approach the end. One interesting question, which is brought up by Matthias, and what we tried in the early days of this, where we would approximate this by a mode function, is we thought, well, you know, obviously what you do is you make use of the one thing that you also know about inflation, acceleration, and that there's a point, epsilon equals one, downstream, where you have to hit in order to get reheated. And so the question was, why don't you put that in as one of the constraints on the rolling of the dice? But that, from the number of E-folds that we observe, is about 50 more E-folds down here. And what you have no idea is how to actually say epsilon is going up towards one. Is it going up slowly, or is it going up fast? The fast is like a waterfall. And so really, we abandoned that we could do anything with these sorts of expansions over the entire range, in spite of the fact that that was a really tight boundary condition for the model. It just didn't become feasible unless you have a theory for, you know, how gentle or how non-gentle your potentials are as they approach the end of inflation. That was a rewording of what you said, Matthias.
And so in doing what you were describing before, let me see if you were actually saying what I thought you were saying. You were saying that you could imagine looking at the data, and were you saying that you could fit as your modes of interest epsilon versus K, or?
Except that the only caveat on that is that it turns out that epsilon isn't the greatest expansion variable to use.
The thing I'm confused about whether or not it's epsilon is, like, how many bins you get to get is a prior, right? I mean, because if, I mean, why are these ones you showed smooth?
Oh, no. This is just to show you the level at which is occurring. If you took epsilon and you decided that that was the thing to be expanding in,
Okay,
let's just say that for the moment, then, you know, maybe we would have of order, well, I'm going to show you results, except not in this specific variable, of sort of 9 bands that we would use. So it's just like, how many bands do you use when you try and characterize the band powers in CL?
But there we do have a driving assumption that we know something about, kind of like the smoothness that's underneath it. And it seems like by choosing...
It is absolutely true. It's one of the issues with mode expansions and trying to do potential reconstructions or anything in the early universe. You need some kind of regularizer on smoothness. If you don't, and one of the easiest regularizers is restricting the number of bands. I will show you another regularizer.
Eta, right?
Say that again?
The derivative of epsilon is eta, and it contributes to the slope.
Okay. Right, but he's saying you expanded something different than epsilon.
You don't want to have epsilon have a change very much over one e-fold, because
Right. Well, actually, having change, it's actually not so easy to make... changes in inflation theory on scales faster than h. And so that actually in itself it imposes a regularizer, if you like. However, we will see that there is also another way to try and decide what the modes are, and I'm going to talk about that in a second. Yeah. Yes, but that's not in here. I mean, it would. But that requires a relationship between... I mean, the thing is, this is relatively single field. So it requires a relationship between FNL and epsilon, which is not so easy. There was an approximate way of doing that that Carlo Cantaldi just put a paper out where he was trying to do constraints FNLR. Where he was using trajectories in a somewhat different form to try and do that constraint.
FNL is epsilon. I mean, there's a cool shape in the paper by Juan, but you needed to crank up this epsilon and eta to be so large in order to have a constraint. I just don't see how.
Yeah, you'll see the kind of epsilon trajectories that come out of this in a moment.
FNL is a linear. The level of non-Gaussianity, as said by FNL, is a combination of epsilon and eta. Get to 10, I mean there's no inflection.
Okay, this is an ancient slide, older data before 2011, which is really ancient in our subject because things have been coming so fast and thick, it's fabulous. So this is with some number of modes that were used. These are of order, 11 or so, and they allowed sort of one sigma trajectories, best fit for epsilons. You could translate this whole story about epsilon into a story about phonons, where the total, emphasis on total, equation of state parameter is the thing that's being probed. And this is probing something. I'll show something different than this in a bit. The relationship of acceleration trajectories now with acceleration trajectories in the late universe associated with dark energy, and you can see that there's a factor of 10 in scale. It is so amusing. But you can, from these trajectories, try and reconstruct the potential. And so you get all sorts of trajectories on the potential. This is an old story. But then you can also try and do direct V determination. I said this isn't a good thing to do. But nonetheless, of course, we tried it in various points. This one is where you enforce a small field constraint based upon the data. And so, essentially the small field constraint drives everything. So I don't want to talk about this. I don't really care about this. The V is not the key issue here. It's the acceleration and its history. and here it was an application that Shiji Wong, who's now, I'm happy to say, in the Planck core team, and I did with the newly released Planck data that used 9 knots of a cubic spline with their knots at these points. And so, you get these kind of filters that overlap, and you can reconstruct the trajectories, and I thought this was really striking how exactly the slope that Planck likes emerged from these trajectories. And so it should, of course, but it could have been because of the incredible increase in the number of parameters, it could have been crazy. Now, if you make a huge number of parameters, it can start to do oscillations like any spline-fitting overshoot that often happens with splines. But it was pretty remarkable how regularized this was. And then the information, once you go to short scales or large scales, is less constraining. But there is a tendency for the power to want to turn down because of the flattening of the, not flattening, the lesser power. If you project from high L down to lower L, as you know, the Planck power that is observed is somewhat less than that projection would give. And so this is part of that drive. And then there's also interesting phenomenology that's occurring at the higher K end, which remains to be seen how stable that will be. That isn't why I'm showing this. What's that?
Sorry, why did the first one go high? So you explained why you started to go down, but then why did the first not go high? Just because there's so much noise.
Oh, no. Look at the spread. Okay. Look at the spread. It doesn't really. Okay, so. Absolutely, absolutely. This was.
That could be severe enough to produce lead lines, non-gas.
Yeah.
I think the claim is that if, as far as I understand it, that if it's very difficult to imagine that something will show up in the non-gaussianity before you see it here.
Yeah, you find it
important. And you
kind of. In the 2-point partial. Is always bigger unless you really want to feel you have to work something that is very
So it is the signal to noise in the power spectrum is much larger than the signal to noise in the frequency function.
If not, and if you also require that the calculation that you're doing is under control.
Yeah.
So okay. You write some. Imagine you want to write something in which you. You have these windows.
But that's way out, but they're very, very complicated. I mean,
the specific question I'm asking is, if you have something which has a little region in the spectrum, which is highly symmetric,
yes,
if you then it can, then you know, that cancels.
Yes, yeah, it will. So
that's right.
But it will. But the signal to noise. So if you, for example, if you detect the oscillation of the power spectrum, the signal to noise 5 in the power spectrum. In the frequency function, maybe the signal to noise 1. I just mean that there is a decrease in the signal to noise. It must be.
You're paying a big price in 10 to the minus 5.
Well, you're paying a price, but you know, if you had some burst, that would have a characteristic temporary shape for them, I'm guessing.
Yeah, I'm talking about the optimal estimation.
This is the exact question that they tried to.
I'm not saying that you cannot detect it. I'm saying that you detect with less signal to noise.
Because you're paying the big price of the 10 to the minus 5.
And the coupling cost. Yeah. But
this expansion was actually designed for the purpose of not going into little anomalies in the CL data. So, you know, it's not trying to pick up something associated with, you know, the little notch at 22. Nor the 1800, even though it may feel it a bit, just like our other templates for different parameters are pretty robust to these things because they don't feel it very much, and the same thing is true here. And if one wanted to, you know, really go after that, you would do something different, and there are ways to go after that that I'll talk about. So the one thing I wanted to just say here, because I'll show other cases later, this is a scan in ln PS of K with these knots. Then the overall amplitude is also scanned, and the value of R is scanned. And so those are the parameterizations. And so you see the point is that instead of it's adding with consistency 9 parameters, well actually 8, because this is effectively like an NS. NS takes one of those parameters away. And so, you know, it's a much larger number of parameters that are being used to derive this information, and yet what emerges is exactly what we did with the single parameter. But that really isn't what I wanted to emphasize about this. I just thought I'd make a comment or two about the kind of mode function expansions. I happen to like B-splines. We use them all the time in SP8, so I've been intimate with them, if you like, since the mid-80s. This is an example with not the 9 but the 8, you know, and obviously they overlap and they interact, and et cetera, et cetera. And you could use these equally well instead of the top hats and doing the band power expansion for CL. And you can see what happens at the pivot, which is where we put the R pivot. You know, it's actually interacting with a few of these bands, and so, you know, it's not simple, the relationship of this, although you can obviously determine that R of K pivot after the fact, and we do. okay, I've mentioned this power spectrum analysis, filtering in quadratic pixel-pixel space, emphasizing any mode functions will do, simple CL band powers, single or a few broad informed CL templates. Simplest is just R, but one thing that we pushed in a paper with my graduate student and Bart's for that matter, Marzia Farang, was that there were a number of simple consistency things that you could do akin to the sort of consistency things that were done in the first DAISY detection of polarization, where you try and make some plots with different evaluations of the same thing. For example, an amplitude multiplying the BB template spectrum and an amplitude multiplying the EE part that is associated with the tensors, and doing a a plot of those with the contours, etc., and saying, oh, you know, it's consistent. Now, how satisfactory or unsatisfactory is that? I think it's kind of neat. It's the sort of thing that we were more or less forced to do in the first phases of the emergence of E-pole. And so, you know, I think it's reasonable for us to consider to doing simple things like that if we do see an emergence for B. Well, no. It turns out that what happens is that if you've got the B, then that you get, and you don't get much on this REE. That's true. But so it's asymmetric, but if you get a really good detection, you can pick it out. This is all designed, in our view, that these are sort of low-order parameterizations that is a phenomenology that is well-designed to use with a pixel-based approach to likelihoods, so that instead of throwing, I mean, what I don't think is necessary, at least in the beginning phases, is that you simultaneously have to vary every cosmic parameter in town, because in fact, R isn't that correlated with the other cosmic parameters. There are a few you have to take care of, but the rest, you know, you can freeze in at Planck best fit values, and that sort of fixes things. Okay. So semi-blind, as I said, there's no such thing as blind, and in this case, it's number of modes which are determining relative stiffness, so that is already imposing a prior on the system. We've tried, you know, all sorts of different modes. Chebyshev was one of our favorites because at high order, it goes over to something that looks very much like a Fourier expansion. The trouble is, it turns out that it's not ever that useful to go after really, really high mode expansions, and I'll explain that in a moment. Top hats, of course, has been traditional, and so all of this is interesting for CL expansions, but it's the inflation modes that are of interest here, and these modes are informed by consistency, as I said, and one of the things that you can do, and we did this we think with recombination histories for an expansion of the ionization fraction of the universe, we expanded those in modes. And there we completely saturated the band over the differential visibility with modes. And then what you do is you use the information in the experiments you have to try and, in a Fisher matrix approach, you try and look for the topmost eigenmodes that give you the most information in their probing that you can get. And so that's another extremely useful way of the development of modes for going after the tensor signal. So you can do the same thing. You can take these epsilons, etc. You can shove it through your likelihood, create a Fisher matrix, and re-rank order modes, and they will have different probing functions, which will be the optimal probing functions.
For example, for this XE, I always thought this was not an interesting thing to do, because it's not putting in any physics that we understand. For example, this Weigel, the XE is going to go down, it needs to recombination. There's a recombination timescale that you can estimate in a piece of paper. Why are we going to put any time and mode that recombines every? I mean, it's not that we are doing this in the vacuum. So I never understood this approach, and I worry that we're going to this approach also in inflation. There we now understand that, so it's fine, maybe you can do more freedom. But I don't see why do things that are not informed. Okay, I don't see why don't.
This is where you're trying to make a quest. I mean, so the most naive aspect of that is that you're doing a slightly informed probe. What happens if you haven't got your entire recombination history story right? Would you be able to detect it in the data? And what we showed is that with a good enough experiment, unfortunately, we don't think Planck is quite good enough, you will have been able to detect that there was a problem with RecFast before the stuff that Jens Kluba and Hirata and company did made them correct it, so it became what, RecFast version 1.5, which they adjusted all the parameters, changed it.
I was talking more reionization.
Reionization, one of the problems there, I mean, that was one of the first ways we were going to try and do it. The trouble is, the data just isn't good enough. There's no way that it can really do a very good job on determining
also,
this.
We know the physics. I don't see why this in arbitrary modes, if we were...
No, I think in that case, you want your modes to be somewhat informed. But, you know, there is the issue is what is the duration of reionization,
like
et cetera.
I totally agree, but never, for example, we know hydrogen cannot recombine, you know, faster than the recombination time, which we can estimate. So.
Well, you'd have to put that in a prior. You would have this big machine out there, and you would give it a trajectory, and then you would go into this machine and crank it and say, I don't like your trajectory, I'm going to reject it, try again, you know? I mean, in other words, that would build up the prior. I'm not saying it's a good thing to do, I'm just saying that would be the strategy in that case. That is to say, you can do these sorts of things and then pass it through whatever your physical requirements are and enforce that the trajectories obey that, and what that does, it makes your prior probability into something which is relatively complex, and you better understand it before you try and make any claims from the data, because you could be driven to an answer just from the prior information of allowed trajectories as opposed to something that's actually being added in a critical way by the data. So I will defend what we did because we think it was actually a neat thing to do. But one of the other aspects is that history, we came up with an entropy criterion for when you stop adding modes. So it turns out that you could at best get information on two modes of relevance for when it was ACT and ACT plus SBT plus WMAP9, and that's the sort of thing that we put into the paper with Armenia. And with Planck, we thought that we could get three modes. We're still fooling around with this because it appears that we're falling short until the polarization information comes in. We really need the polarization information in order to try and better constrain the recombination history. But the point is that you can do the same thing here. And so what that means is that you get these sort of low order, high value modes that will tell you, they're trying to optimally decide in the information you have where the probes are. And so you can get preferred amplitudes for those. And from those preferred amplitudes, you can make trajectories, just like you can in the other case. It's just that these modes are different modes, and they're determined by a different mechanism, which is this choice based upon eigenmode ranking. And then with a truncation criterion, how far you go. Now, these don't always look like the prettiest modes, and so what is the physical interpretation? Sometimes you can make a very direct physical interpretation, but sometimes it's not so easy to do because it mixes too much in terms of physical phenomena and mixes too much in terms of the information of the specific experiment. But it is a consistent way to go, and it's a different thing to do than the usual thing, where the only thing I will do is to compress onto a few band powers, try and do a calculation of what the window function is, and then do a very simple likelihood calculation, as opposed to something which is, you know, different. Not necessarily hugely better, but different. Since the goal of all of this, usually, is to go after physical parameters that we're after, when you do a low-order band power compression, a really significant issue is whether the space of the even lower-order cosmic parameter that you're after, whether it actually is encompassed by the band power space. And the answer is, it might not be. And so You know, you have to be careful with all of these things, and so the more ways that you approach the data, the better, and I think that this is an interesting thing to do. this is the reconstructed NS of that thing that we saw before. You're taking derivatives at each value of k, and there's a little bit of attempt to do slight oscillations in the best fit of that, but you know, it's still in effective agreement with Planck, but it's just the restatement of what we just saw with the law in PS. It's actually the numerical derivative. And this is the reconstructed acceleration that you get from that, and there's an interesting feature of this, which is kind of amusing. Well, first of all, you see that because there were 9 knots here, it isn't really wildly varying. In fact, it's got these really flat components of what is allowed. But the curious thing here is that here is the Planck limit on R. So this is 95% confidence, and yet when you do this opening up of the degrees of freedom in epsilon, it appears that the data, which is taking into account everything simultaneously, including the information on the tensors, and you know, because of the relationship, it's all there. It isn't actually doing it. It's not actually, you know, focusing all of these trajectories so they go below this line. This is another way of saying that there's a big prior dependence on the constraint on R, and in this case, it's been opened up. If I did a logarithmic prior, it would end up closing down. And so, you know, that's something just to bear in mind. Yeah, I mean, it does get sparse. It definitely gets sparse. And, you know, there's sort of random choices, not all of the trajectories, obviously. It's just to give an illustration of what it looks like. A better way to do it is to actually reband it and make, errors from the scatter. That's the better way to actually sort of represent the data. What was the question? Yeah, I mean, but it's a different, I mean, if you like, it's a different representation of the Planck data, but it's a...
It's not prior to R. It's Planck on the spectrum.
Yeah, it was long PS, yeah. The long PS is a uniform prior in each of the bands. And then, it is true that what does happen is there's reconstruction that's going on in terms of determining, everything about the spectrum.
Personally, what Georgie says is that maybe the models that have an R bigger than the limit, LOL, go down,
That's right.
That's correct. That's correct.
Then you can call.
That's right. That's right. For very specific model, exactly. Right. It's exactly right. So you allow yourself semi-blind freedom, and you can reinterpret what you're seeing. And of course, you may tell me that your prior is excluding that class of possibilities, and I say, where did you get your prior from? But, you know, that would be the important issue. And it's a different sort of way of trying to probe things, and I think it's always useful to kick the can in terms of opening up the space in order to see what's robust and what isn't. I thought I'd say some minor words about these things. Oh yeah, so this is just some other examples of the same thing, spider, looking forward to spider plus plank plus Euclid plus chime. This is already with the 2.5 years of plank, actually including some foreground approximations, which are probably a little optimistic, but nonetheless, they were used to show that with the two experiments together, you might get down to as low as 0.02, and that you would detect that was, you know, that there would be a good detection at the 0.12 level, which is the m squared phi squared. A way of seeing that, and of course we've seen that much here, and people will say, yeah, but we don't want to see that because it's a forecast. This is where we are now. This is a likelihood plot, tensor power, and the only point, and this is a re-expression of what everybody has been saying, we have these models where moving in on the models. This one here in R is the monodromy model with the linear phi as well as the sine term. So pseudo-Nambu Goldstone boson plus phi. It's here. It's a great target. We're going to burst through those with a whole class, and Keck and Biceps are sort of getting very close. Maybe Keck's probably already in the can with the information to do this. Spider, 0.08 of the sky, first thing, it should be able to penetrate into here. Improved spider will do a little bit better. This was some version of ABS. ABS 2 is some one of the lines here, which is going to be sort of right in that territory if everything goes right. And that was interesting because it was splitting up the sky into four patches. And it was still doing pretty well. And there was a time when we had great hopes that Quiet 2 would be funded, and it too was going to be in that territory. But it doesn't appear that that's going to happen. And another interesting characterization, which, yes, I agree, it can be moved around. This is the Lithe bound. And so I think it's really neat to try and move through that. For parameters that are essentially like CORE, which was the precursor of PRISM and PIXIE, you get a, this is what the kind of likelihood supposedly would be, with some kind of assumptions on foregrounds, which are probably too optimistic. And then this is what a detection might look like. So in other words, where we are now is essentially like the square root of the, you know, where we could ultimately go. That's sort of obvious. So then how well can we ever do in this game? And we have talked a bit about the spectrum. We can go to 100 or so an L, so that's a longer arm than the 30 or so we could go with COBE. But the kind of errors on NT, even with great observations, aren't going to be infinitely better than the kind of NS constraints we got just from COBE. And so that was sort of at the plus or minus 0.2 level. And so we're never going to be able to try and womp it down unless there was a way that the gravity wave, the gravity waves weren't trying to rush away as soon as they come in the horizon, but that's what they do. And so this is the consistency line, R against NT, for a couple of cases. In this case, the spider was chosen for F sky at 0.15. And here's Planck. And this was some parameters associated with the CMB pole. So, you know, about the best we can get. And so, you know, you would be getting in here, but this is such a steep curve, or steep line, that you just can't get to show that consistency holds. That isn't to say, and as Leonardo emphasized, that it isn't really important to try and move on this NT. You've got to do it, but it's never going to be at the level which is going to be a high precision test. It may be good enough for what you're saying, but it's never going to be that great, and the reasons are sort of obvious.
But
so,
I think for PIXIE, because isn't the PIXIE?
Say it again?
That was what I was asking before.
The what?
Can you, like, fix it?
Yeah, yeah, I'm just showing you what those results look like. I know, it's rather surprising and a bit depressing, but that's life. Say that again?
Yeah, I mean, the detection R was super good.
Yeah, no, no, R is great. R is great.
You're saying it's sample variance on
yeah.
Because the peak is at large angular scale.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah. Yeah, sample variance is what screws up the determination of NT to high accuracy, just like it did for COVID, right? And so it required the much larger lever arm in order to actually, the lever arm with the small sample variance. If we could measure what? No, 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 this is including L equals 100. Yeah. When it first popped out, oh my God. But yeah.
It has a sample variance error of like 0.1.
Yeah. And you know that's Kobe was 0.2. So what we've used when we've done foreground cleaning, very optimistic. There was something that was done for one of these white papers which says that you have your foregrounds and you can clean them down to some controllable number of the foregrounds. So the number that was put in there was 5%. So that you can get rid of most, but there will always be a residual of, let's say, 5%. And obviously we vary that number, but that gives us the basic shape and the basic L's that it goes after. What's interesting is just you doing something simple like that, the value that we get for Planck is very similar to what George was saying. With Planck 2.5, in an ideal world, it could have gotten 0.02. When we add this simple foreground thing, it goes up to 0.05. And with Spider, we had 0.015 and it went up to 0.02. So it was better because it's a much smaller region of the sky. And it emphasized how much Planck was really into, just as George said, really into the reionization bump. And another thing that we played around with, because we had great hopes for this, and it's not as awful as you might expect, and so this is why I'd actually like to get George's reaction. One thing that you can do, you can build lots and lots of effective spider 8% using different regions of the sky, and then the question is, doing that with the lesser, hopefully, some of them with lesser foregrounds, that is to say, a stacking in terms of strength of the foregrounds, can't Planck do something which is reasonable with that information? And George says definitely no, and it didn't look quite so awful from our perspective. I mean, I think there's no question it would be something really interesting to do. It's just a question of, you know, do you think, I mean, it's true that, you know, when you've got your 1,000+ detectors and you're focusing on a region and you have an explicit observing strategy, which just focuses all your attention on that region, you're gonna win. But, you know, Planck has a lot of regions that it gets to play with, and so it can do better, not really, really better, but a bit better on those regions. I mean, it will be done. There's no question, I think. Let's see if I actually have a figure that illustrates any of that. Yeah. Yeah, okay. Maybe this does. This was for spider-like configuration with no R, basically, 0.01, or with an M squared phi squared like R input. And this is showing what the two sigma constraints are, and one using a full pixel treatment, one doing an L-space estimation. Usually that works fairly well, but not always. And then this is with this foreground approximation that I was showing you of how it was doing. And we found that there was this pretty good trough around 8% that was related to the choice, not the only reason, but related to the choice of 8% that you heard that Bart said about what fraction of the sky we're going to be. So this was actually a pretty informative study for how much of the sky. But what we were pretty pleased about is that that it was a fairly broad region that has similar constraints, and so that you can do quite well on smaller patches of the sky, and that's of course your strategy. So you know, that was pretty interesting. We thought that this fully takes into account the EB mixing associated with finite sky, right? And we thought that that was going to cause the errors to really go up, but it doesn't. So it's not bad. If you really shut down, obviously it's going to create problems. But anyway, so we thought, well, that's pretty good because it's a nice story for the ground base, right? It's actually, you know, you can use these fields, nice control, and you still get good value. See, I know you guys all know this, but it was instructive for us to do it. Because, you know, there was a story associated, it was the reason I asked the question. We had a story associated with why balloons were going to be so great, and we were worried about, you know, how good Keck could be, and I've changed my mind. Of course, you had it all along, but, you know, this was influential for me. Anyway, this is the Planck example, where you don't get to go back and use the same thing, and so these are, if you have the full fraction of the sky, when you're getting the reionization bump, you're doing very well. And, yeah, okay. So what this was, I'm trying to remember what the stump plot is. What happens with Planck is that the foregrounds, even with full sky, make this sort of 0.05 number like George got. And if you cut down the fraction, it's going up quite a bit, starting to lose the once you start to lose the reionization bump, doesn't do so well. But this one was, okay, I won't say any more about that because it didn't have foregrounds. yeah. I think so. Okay, I've made these points. Yeah, that's a good thing to end on. Okay, so here are the few of the points. No. These are a few of the points I made, but I think I've chatted about all of them. So that'll do. Well, what we were doing was, so we got Mark Antoine to use various models to try and do a rank ordering. It, you know, he's the dusty guy, one of the dusty guys on Planck, to rank order the sky, just like you did with the FSD models, but to do it with somewhat, well, now ultimately with the Planck data, but this is with the sky model, which was essentially his modification of it, to try and see, you know, what the rank ordering in terms of cleanliness is for patches of various skies. And so what we were trying to do there was motivated by that, and trying to see whether there's anything that could be done with smaller patches with the Planck so that you would just make a whole bunch of them.
But then it would stack the results, yeah.
Effectively, yeah. But anyway, if I look at those figures, it looks like there is one case where it's good, but it didn't have the foregrounds properly treated. So I don't want to say anything about it.
Like once you know this thing, you can inform at least masking that you do afterwards to verify, you know, what you had.
Yeah, if you were to find anything, what people would want to see is how frequency dependent your results are. If we're high, then you can do a bit of a full time. If the bar is at the limit, you stop.
But you know that when the Planck polarization data with BMO is ultimately released, I'm sure that you're going to look at your fields with them, right? I mean, makes sense. Right? And so everybody's going to look at it, and the interesting issue is whether it's just going to be so noisy nothing can ever be seen. And you're saying it's just so noisy nothing can ever be seen. What about cross-correlation? You cross-correlate, let's say, Keck data with the equivalent polarization region of Planck. You don't think you could tease anything out? Maybe not. Yeah, no, well, you will do that, right? But as well, you know.
Well, one thing we could use is EMO over a wider range than we observe, than we really understand specific E to B regions.
Sexual mode. Beyond our map coverage.
Just one angle to scale off the edge of our map.
Yeah. Just larger. Just larger.
Yeah, so you don't have to take the hit from the EB mixing parameter.
Yes. Around the edges of the map. Yeah. It's all there. Mm-hmm. Like it's at any angle of scale, just
I think that'll help. But if you don't get any. We don't have a maximum likelihood.
Well, but it's done in an optimal way. It's actually, I think it's far superior. I mean, than trying to do the, it's probably even there. Ah, the CBI approach to polarization, which actually.
Having an EMO map that extends a little bit bigger
would be moderately useful. Even in an maximum likelihood framework where everything is not optimal. I think that would allow you to use a little bit more information in your map.
Right. Oh, no, I think combining is great. Absolutely.
Does that have to be to the same depth? I mean, can't you make your own?
Well, I think I would.
No, we might be missing lots of
models. She's right. So we apodize and we throw out that area around the edge. But for the EMOs, we don't mean to. Right? They continue to have high signals in order to throw that out. Hmm.
Do you only use one appetizer?
We're saying it was hopeless to go after BMO instead. L80 in quant data. Is that true even?
I've looked at this specifically for polarization. The thing is that we've got this. But you've still got, offset variations. So you will see those things.
And they are not particularly clear.
I think we really looked at it, and it was not clear.
Yeah, in the South Star, there's the
polarity.
But how much does the LMC cut out of the region that's high hit? Everything?
I don't know. Try to use that to compute the polarization with one detector and compare the detector with each other. So we use also these regions.
If I understand your initial thinking on comparing balloons to ground, you had some thought, maybe it was a qualitative thought, that you thought balloons would have some advantage.
Well, that we would go for a larger region of the sky, and there would be... We went into this project because we thought that EB mixing was going to be an issue, and we now don't think it's much of an issue. So that was basically... I wouldn't say a revelation, but it was certainly something that took us by surprise, because there were so many papers that were saying, we got to do all of this cutting out of modes because they're in some sense evilly contaminated and all of this. And it was, it was good work, but it was all being done in amplitude space, not amplitude space, which is a better way to do it.
The proposal was written before the Smith estimator came along, right? Is that correct? The Kendrick Smith pseudo CL estimator, or Spider proposal.
Yeah, yeah.
So I remember these discussions.
That was the other thing, is that certainly with the computers we have in Toronto, we figured out we could do this, right? Now, the issue we have, and this is what I think is going to happen, we're going to use a hybrid approach, but we will use, at least for some limited number of parameters, we will do the full blast pixel-based approach with no cut. It's just going to be the whole thing. But we won't be able to do that for, the whole set of cosmological parameters. That's too big a space. Well, except that the way it's true, what we were thinking of is more like building grids in the relevant parameters. And so it's true, but anyway, maybe we were too intimidated by, I guess my point here is, actually, there is a topic that I wouldn't mind discussing here, but the first point is that most of the parameters are being determined by other things, for example, Planck, and so it doesn't actually matter in terms of trying to draw out this, which we already know is a very subdominant parameter, and so it's almost perturbative in its form relative to, what's mostly pushing the data, and so that allows some, shortcuts, and maybe what you want in the end is a full-blown everything varying simultaneously, but you can do a lot of useful exploration with fixing it at sort of best values, maybe the parameters, without having them all floating around. For example, you would never have the high frequency nuisance parameters floating around when you're trying to work with spire. I mean, it just wouldn't happen. So here is a question which I have my own view of, but I really want to hear it since you're actually bashing the data as we speak. Everybody's talking about de-lensing and all of this. Forward modeling is a totally logical way to go. And parameters, I mean, it's true you can let everything float, but parameters that are determined at higher, from higher L information, propagate into essentially forecasting in the disturbed region what the lensing contribution should be, and how accurate is that, and what is it you're gaining out of these delensing hopes?
Right, so they lens their E to grade B, and then they put noise in it and run it through the pipeline. Seems to be working.
No, that's a pipeline, but I'm just talking about varying all of the parameters that can have an impact on the lensing signal within the thing that you're trying to do as a detection for R.
Insystematic parameters.
No, I'm thinking more, you know, just the parameters that are determining the strength of the lensing. Say it again?
Dark energy, for example, will change the aperture.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I mean, do you really need to do all of those changes simultaneously with trying to draw out the, you know, the value of R?
You're offering an alternative instead of de-lensing.
It's almost template based, but maybe with simple parameters. That was what I thought would be the simplest thing to do, and that I thought it would be pretty accurate. And trying to do everything simultaneously seems to me to be just, well, in the first instance, it's not necessary, I think. And in the second instance, okay, you'll try and do further corrections to make sure everything works properly and you aren't making the wrong inference. Exactly, and that's the sort of thing we did in the work with Marzia. We did do some exploration of the variation of those parameters to see is this a reasonable assumption to do. But in my view, maybe wrong, is that the forecast probably allows you to do a fairly good. Separation of the two signals.
The first thing you can do is just assume some canonical parameters, and the second thing is that we just throw out a scale up and down.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, although that's not exactly, I mean, the shape is the issue, where it's actually penetrating. I mean, you know, all it's doing is costing you a little bit in the. Say it again? Exactly. Yeah. Anyway, so that was the sort of scenario I thought would be the, and you weren't in disagreement. So the delensing aspect, I always wondered, is that really a necessary thing to do?
Experimental waterfall shrink down, when you come down towards that lensing spectrum, the first thing you can do is just subtract it. It's just say, now it's there.
Yeah, exactly.
Go really far.
So I think you can go very far, but the disadvantage is you can't pinpoint, look, this spatial mode is, you know, V mode from the gravity wave. Lensing it, so fundamentally you can't just say, oh.
Look at the sample of that. When you're subtracting it out, the sample variance and what you're subtracting, right?
Yes.
Yeah, but, you know, that's small. If the lensing works,
No, delensing's got a whole, it's got a whole correlation matrix associated with it.
Eventually you can take it out completely if it wasn't for detector noise. And, because you have two maps, E and B, and there's two maps, E and kappa. So if you could, I mean, this is the hierarchy.
Well, I know, but that's the...
I mean, on the absence, so...
I know, but I should be able to do that just in the quadratic space. Is that it? That's it.
Oh, no,
that was our discussion after the fact, right?